First, let me begin by saying where the ideas came from that got me started thinking along the lines of the material that I'd like to spend a few minutes with you here this evening. I preached my first sermon here as a preacher for this congregation on the 19th of July. So it's been just a month ago, and thinking, of course, around any anniversary, whatever the ties may be, that bring about a yearly remembrance. Of course, you are wont to think in terms of successes and failures and incompletions and just general thoughts of the future as well. What might I do more effectively? What might we do as a group more effectively? And so really this sermon, I think, got started, you know, just a month or two ago as we were approaching that particular anniversary, my first year with you. I have to say that the loss of Betty New recently also caught my attention very powerfully. So I was thinking about endings and changes in the congregation here. As a matter of fact, Jerry will be embarrassed to find out, but he plays a role in this material as well, because while we have not been close, of course, throughout our preaching careers, we knew of each other, respected each other, and the year that I've been able to spend with him has been most precious to me. And then when he got sick here, and as he described it, hit a wall. And it was so dramatic. The man that I had known, you know, was just struck down like he was physically so completely. Of course, he's back among us at probably 98% strength now since that. But nonetheless, it caught my attention, to say the least. And I thought in terms of how much I would miss this man that I've come to love so deeply in the course of the year that we've been working together. And then, Harold's move. Harold, 2 out of 4 have to do with you this evening. The thoughts that it had brought me to the courage, maybe it is, to say that there are some things I would just like to lay in front of the congregation here. And before I go any farther, I want everyone to understand that what I'm about to present, the ideas that I'm to present, really nothing new to you at all. But I want no one to make a mistake that what I'm presenting is not a criticism in any way. If you're tempted somehow to think that I have a sort of a negative attitude about this, or that it is, you know, sort of a finger-pointing thing, it truly, really, actually, for surely, is not. But I've just been, you know, rattled in my cage for the last couple of months, and as these various thoughts have been in there and tossing back and forth, I thought maybe this would be a good night for us to consider some things. The endless bulletin announcements that we have about the various maladies that are assailing this congregation also played a fifth and very prominent role. We have a large number of people who are ailing and facing a whole battery of different problems in some cases. And so that, too, you know, has been a part, or coloring, let's say, much of my thinking in the last couple of months. You know, my point being is some things are really pretty obvious and you don't need a crystal ball to see them. So these things have been powerful things, they've been important things, and so, you know, it's not like they're really mystical and amazing, you know, and unusual what I'm going to discuss either. And first I just wanted to start, you know, with hardcore, cold and hard statistics. I went through recently, the last couple of weeks, and a couple of times, as a matter of fact, and just carefully counted the members of this congregation that would be considered adults, not our teenagers, not our school agers, you know, but adults. And as you go through the directory, we have, by my count at least, 106 adult members of the Coburg Road congregation. And 36 of them are 70 or older. And so, as you've seen in my list of 5 reasons, I've had on my mind passages and endings of life and of relationships. 36 of our 106 members are 70 or above. Now, as a matter of fact, I'm not sure, but what the number's actually larger, that someone wasn't so sure about, might actually be, you know, 38, maybe even 40. And I was so shocked at the realization, you know, of that number. As I say, I went back and counted again. I had to think about that again. And sure enough, exactly one-third, or possibly 34, 35% maybe, of this congregation is 70-plus. Well, in the light of a passage like James 4, which says that we're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away, and as we have discovered, you might hit a wall and suddenly be leaving us, you know, that's food for thought. And especially in the light of Psalm 90, which says, by divine revelation, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. I don't know, maybe it is the fitness consciousness of America that has made our life expectancy stretch out a little bit longer, but on the average still, they, as I understand, last time I looked anyway, I think 78 is the average life expectancy in America. So while it's been creeping up year by year, and we gain a few months and then a year, you know, every so often, we're still in the time frame that God has set. We are, all of us, just smoke. Dust in the wind, as the old song goes. We are, all of us, sharing, participating in an experience called life that is expected to terminate somewhere in the course of our eighth decade. That's the way of life. If you are particularly strong, if you are just a Goliath in a good sense, as Harold has been, you may see some more years than that, but it's really not to be counted upon. It's not to be expected. And as I've been thinking about that, you know, I've noted that these people who are in that category of 70 plus are among some of our major contributors, the people that we really depend upon. I don't mean just financially, so though surely they stand out in that regard, but in their attendance, in their outreach efforts to their friends and neighbors, these are leaders among us, and they are pillars that are supporting our roof, and they are foundation stones in our entire structure. If you think about that particular age frame, you will do so, I think in most cases, with a great deal of respect and maybe almost awe for the faithfulness and the sacrifice, the effort that one-third of our congregation, an unusually high percentage, you know, has offered us, has provided for us, and upon which this congregation has been built. Now, here's a chart. I'll give you pause. I know it did for me. That's not an actual graph. I just got, you know, a graphic here. But brethren, if the preceding two verses are true, and you and I wouldn't be here tonight if we didn't think so, in the next 5 to 10 years, we can expect our adult population to decline from 106 to 70. We'll still have our younger folk, you know, and the congregation will be larger than that 70, maybe. And that's a shocker. And as a matter of fact, I know there are many congregations that are smaller than this. The average church, in fact, in America, across the board in all religious groups, it's not just among us, but in all of the various denominational groups as well, is only 60. That's the average size congregation. So I know there's a lot of congregations get along just fine, you know, with smaller numbers. But 70, really, in my experience, and in thought processes at least, you know, is pretty well just a self-sustaining congregation that is, if you will, kind of marginal. That's really what you need as a baseline. And as I've been looking back on this last year and thinking about the nature of the work that we've done together, it's stunning for me to think that a third of the folks that I have come to know and love so well may be leaving us in the next 5 to 10 years. Certainly a major percentage of them will. Now, I'd like to say humorously, this is not the reason why I suggested that those 60 and under come, and I certainly wasn't saying that those of you older shouldn't. Several of you accosted me about that humorously. Oh, I know what, we can't come. And we're older than 60. And certainly, you understand my spirit. You know, I'm not trying to strike fear and terror in anybody that's over the age of 70 either. I'm just saying, brethren, these are the facts of life. In fact, I've entitled this sermon for my own record keeping, "The Way of Life, The Way of All Men, The Way of the World," might be other ways, you know, to describe it. There are many other passages that deal with these realities. But as I look at that chart, you know, again, it's just shocking to me. And it occurred to me that it might be well for me to finally just get this off my mind, if you will, and burden myself a little bit, but also maybe to impress each and every one of you with a very stark reality. This congregation is about to change very rapidly. It will shortly be very different. And it will shortly be much smaller, perhaps a third smaller, if something doesn't change. If we don't see significant growth, if we don't see significant additions to the congregation here, then this congregation will be a shadow of its historical self in a decade. That's shocking to me. And so I thought tonight we would just look at a very few verses as a means of only trying to say to ourselves, let's be aware of that and ask ourselves personally, not at all in the sense of saying, you know, you, you're just not getting the job done, but just saying to ourselves, let us be aware that we need to plot a course. We need to have some view to the future. We need to appreciate what needs to go in to a thriving and growing congregation. Now, one little caveat. I understand, and you know you've heard me preach this several times, that we may do the planting and the watering, and God grants the increase. It is not up to us to make a congregation grow. And a congregation may be doing spectacularly well in the sight of God and dwindle away to nothing for reasons that are beyond our knowing, for circumstances that are beyond our control. This is not a finger-pointing exercise in a guilt trip. You know, it's not that at all. It's just to draw us up, you know, and say, be aware. Be very conscious and thinking regularly. Let it be abiding in your mind that this congregation is changing, and it is changing in attendance, at least, in membership, dramatically downward in these next 10 years. And so as a means of just motivating, maybe, or offering some cautionary advice, you know, I would start with Joshua tonight. Let's go to Joshua chapter 2. In Joshua in the second chapter, of course, it's the second chapter of Joshua, then we are just entering those Old Testament saints are, the Jews crossing the Jordan River, entering into their promised land, and beginning the great and terrible, energetic work of acquiring that land by means of war. They had much hard work and sacrifice and loss of life that lay ahead of them. In chapter 2, though, and starting in verse 6, it says there, that's not what I want. Hold on a second. What have I done here? It's Judges I'm looking for. More than Judges, I've got the wrong book. Judges, they both start with J. That's close enough, isn't it? Okay, Judges. Okay, look at verse 6 now, chapter 2 in the book of Judges, which is only a short time frame after the entering into the promised land, and still directly related to that. And so look at chapter 2 and verse 6. When Joshua, the very man who wrote the book, why he's on our minds, had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went, each to his inheritance, to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gosh. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them, who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. the lesson, I'm guessing, will be pretty apparent, you know, in looking at those verses. Joshua enters into the promised land, and the people are excited. They are of a mind to conquer the world for their God. They are of a mind to be very much builders, because they're coming in to a brand new land. And so, with great vim and vigor, these people, inheriting God's promises, entered into that land and did wondrous exploits that you read about in the book of Joshua, and now we've come to the end of Joshua himself, his death. But do you see the generational shift that's taking place here in Judges chapter 2? People are very faithful, and they're doing well in the days of Joshua, and the elders, you know, after that, that remembered the beginnings, that remembered the building, that remembered the work, which is not just done by God, though he's mentioned twice as doing these things for these people, they were involved in that work as well. These things were done because of a joint action between God's working and their working. Brethren, that example, that pattern of being excited and really involved and sacrificial and participating, you know, for beginnings is something you'll see time and again in Scripture. And then the inheritors of all of that work, the next generation, when the houses have been built and the forests have been cleared and the fields have been tilled and the crops have become regular and consistent, and all of these homes have been built so that they're quite comfortable, you know, we get a generation or two down the road, the inheritors, the following generation, the children, as they grow, don't seem to have the same appreciation for the blessings they have in the sight of their God. They don't seem to be quite as energetic and as devoted. They don't spend nearly as much time in the works of their God as that preceding generation had done. You know this if you're Bible students at all. It's a cycle that the book of Judges is now going to repeat quite a few times, as a matter of fact. And we would do well, brethren, to recognize, to be very conscious of the fact that an entire generation that represents a third of this congregation is leaving us one way or another soon, quickly, and inexorably. There's no turning back from that fact. And the generation that has reached this building and this size of a congregation needs to recognize that a great and terrible temptation is at your feet. Many people in this building had nothing to do with the sacrifice that went in to establishing a new congregation, buying the property, building that structure. We just inherited it. It's just what we've always known. We moved in and occupied. Raise your hand if you were here, I forget now, if it's 65 or 66, when the building was built. 65 and 66. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that were here at that time. 6. Okay, 6 people that have been here all that time since 65 when the structure was built. Do you suppose they feel differently, those half a dozen here tonight, about what went in to making this happen? When the building was built, somebody tell me, you know, just yes or no, did it have 106 adult members when it started? Did it have half of that? Did it have a third of that? Somewhere in the 40s? Not even that? Okay? That core group, with 6 are still with us, they dug in. They cared. They made it a priority. It was overwhelming in their conscience. They spent money. They spent time. They worked at this. And they told their neighbors. And they brought into being a thriving congregation that I've well heard about time and again
clear up a 5-hour drive 300 miles away from here made me anxious to want to be a part of it. But I will never know that congregation. Never know it. The congregation I've come to was already 50 years old. It was a different group. It was really that next generation with a few of you unusually healthy individuals defying the odds we love so deeply and appreciate. All I'm saying tonight is, brethren, know this and know it right well. And then ask yourself, am I really just coasting and skating along in comfort here because these others have worked so hard? I'm just standing on their shoulders, but I am not doing what they did. Because if you're not, then the congregation that grew over the course of these 50-some years, that congregation, brethren, isn't going to be growing. It isn't going to be thriving. It may not even be anymore. Got to grapple with that, you youngsters that are 60 and younger. Okay? You youngins, it's your time. It's your turn. And it's now or never. Because there's not a lot of time before we'll find ourselves starting over, like it or not, with the same number and resources that did this so long ago. I'm pretty sure you feel like I do. Be better off to keep this ball rolling and to all of us dig in like has been done in the past in the creative days, so that we continue then at least to offer before our God our effort that He might bless it with the increase that only He can control. The next passage I'm not going to comment on a whole lot, but I have you turn over there to Nehemiah. I think most all of you, again, are going to know this passage, and therefore doesn't need a lot of comment. But the spirit of these people at this time, who were not the first generation. Nehemiah is in the 400s B.C. Nehemiah is in a time of building and renewing. Nehemiah is going to take on a task of crumbled walls being restored. But in Nehemiah's day, we're going to sure see some people who knew what it was like to dig in. So in Nehemiah 4, it came about that when Sanballat, he's an enemy of the Jews, heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. And he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish it in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" Now, Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, "Even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." "Hear, O God," Nehemiah prays, "how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders." So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now that's the verse, it's the primary point in reading through this whole chapter. Can you say that about yourself? Are you really sure, brethren, if the heavens parted and Jesus appeared on those clouds right now, the building was rent asunder and you looked up to see the Son of God, and He asked you, did you have a mind to work in 2013, in 2012, in 2011? Can you accurately be described as having had a mind to work? Well, I hope so. You could look up and say, "Yes, Lord, by Thy grace, that describes who I am." Well, being that that's the case, in verse 7, came about when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on, despite all the mockery and their efforts to stop it, and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry.
They were angry enough to begin with. And all of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. But we prayed to our God. And because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. Thus, Judah, it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. Yet there is much rubbish. And we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. I mean, let's think about that moment in which they had worked to the point of utter exhaustion and were just falling down dead on their feet, didn't think they could finish it. Could that accurately describe your involvement in the work of the Lord in Eugene, Oregon in 2013? Is that what you're doing for your God? Working to the point of exhaustion. Then in verse 11, our enemy said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. I don't think we're any of us facing murder. And it came about when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the walls, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. And when I saw, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Again, I would pause and ask, is that the spirit of the Coburgians? Is that the spirit of this church? That we are fighting for all that is precious to us, our families. That we are fighting then with a view to the future, to the life, and the success of those we love in the family of God, in the body of Christ, in the work of the Lord, that upon the departure of a third of this congregation, there will still be workers devoted with all that is within them to the point of exhaustion because of a mind of work, that this work will endure. This work will go on. This work is unfailing. This work will be everything that our God and His Christ and the Holy Spirit would have it be. We are those people in our generation that the saints and giants of old were in theirs. Is that us? And if it's not you, it's time to rise up and do something about it. Then isn't it? Time to shake off that dust and say, you know, I really have enjoyed a tremendous amount of blessings from all of those that have gone before. And now it is time for me to provide those blessings for those who will come after. Continuing then, in verse 15, it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And it came about from that day on that half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand, doing the work, and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. He would blow the trumpet in case of an attack. 19, and I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So, we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. At that time also said to the people, let each man with his servants spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So neither I nor my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. And yes, brethren, we'll find out in chapter 6 that that went on for 52 days and just near miraculously built all the wall. 52 days. Do not be tempted, nor listen to that voice of Satan whispering in your ear that, well, you know, had I been there for 52 days, I could do that too. But it was a physical work, it was only for a couple of months, and, you know, there's no comparison here. But there's every comparison here. And we, all of us, know this. These were people who were devoted night and day to the work of building. These were people whose minds were filled night and day with the cause of their God. These were the people who night and day wanted to create something that was defensible, that would endure, that would allow that the people of God would go on. And of course, this stands as an example for us, who will also experience times where there are flurries of activity, where you really have to dig in, you know, but that spirit, that mind to work, the attitude that produced these kinds of people, that's a constant. There were no excuses among these people. There were no easier ways and more convenient ways. There was no, well, when I get around to it or if I feel like it, kind of spirit among these people. Now, through the ages, that spirit has come and it has gone. It has come again, and it has gone again, many, many, many times. We only, each of us, need to ask ourselves at what point on that cycle and on that scale do we find ourselves personally. Please open up backwards now in point of time, but to 2 Samuel in chapter 24. Just a few verses here. It also manifests a spirit that makes the difference, I believe, brethren, between success and failure. In 2 Samuel 24, starting in verse 18, Gad came to David that day, and he said to him, "Go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite." David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded. And Arunah looked down and saw the king and his servants crossing over toward him, and he went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. Then Arunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" And David said, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord that the plague may be held back from the people." Arunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, the yokes of the oxen for the wood. Everything, O king, Arunah gives to the king." And Arunah said to the king, "May the Lord your God accept you." In other words, you want to offer a sacrifice, then I'll pay for all of it. However, in verse 24, the king said to Arunah, "No, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver, and David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus, the Lord was moved by entreaty for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. I won't offer anything that didn't cost me something to my God. Now that's a spirit. That's a spirit that says, not what others do, ever. Not what others are doing. That's not what involves my time or I care about. And that's certainly not something that I'm going to come to depend upon. What am I doing? What does it cost me? What have I invested in money? What have I invested in time? What have I invested in energy? What am I doing? Am I just lackadaisically capitalizing when it's convenient and I'm well-rested and there's nothing else on TV, you know, to be here? Because, brethren, that doesn't cost you anything. But when you say, it'll hurt, I'm going to have to extend a little farther. I might be a little more tired. I might be a little more broke. I might, you know, just have some whack here. But I'll offer to my God. And when it costs me something, then it's dear to me, and it's dear to Him. In Titus chapter 2, which is the passage that I quoted this morning toward the end of our lesson, and I had read again tonight. I asked Ralph to do it, and so he read to you just a moment ago. We have a passage that's been on my mind lately. Titus chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. Likewise urge the young man, I stand before you, brethren, because this is my job. And it's not my job because you pay me to do it. It would be my job if you didn't pay me to do it. For 27 years, when Don and I were building a brand new congregation up at Smoky Point, I worked two jobs for 27 years. I worked, in a sense, three jobs. And then I had kids. That's five jobs. We never missed an assembly, ever. I worked 6 days a week delivering the mail for 14 years, brethren, to pat myself on the back a little bit. I worked 6 to 10 hour days, 6 days a week, for 14 years, so I could preach. And we built a pretty nice little congregation there. And then we built a building there, and it still stands. I designed it myself. I acted as the general contractor, did much of the work myself, alongside the saints. We had a mind to work, and we were building, because we'd inherited nothing at Smoky Point. Congregation's there to this day. But the people, brethren, the people there, you don't know excuses. So in this verse 6, urge the young men, and I do so because it is my job as a Christian and as a preacher, and not as an employee, to urge you to be sensible. In all things, show yourself an example of good deeds. Every member of this congregation ought to be able to point at every other member and say, that's the attendance we expect out of everybody. That's the contribution we expect out of everybody. That's the amount of energy we expect out of everybody. Because that person is the shining example of everything we're trying to accomplish. And if they can't do that, then maybe I'm failing in my job, but I'm urging you tonight, be sensible. You think about this. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds with purity of doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, in order that the opponent may be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Now, if you hear Satan whispering, oh, yeah, but you know, that's the letter to Titus. Titus is a preacher. Doesn't apply to me. You know better than that now, don't you? Nobody escapes this. Everybody's supposed to be sensible. Everybody's supposed to be pure doctrine. Everybody is supposed to be what Titus 2 says. I have no doubt that God will bless the work at Coburg Road if everybody has a mind to work, like young Titus was being taught to work. Then, finally, with Hebrews 12 in verses 1 through 3. In that 12th chapter, we have a famous opening to that chapter, which is building upon an entire chapter about faith. So it begins with the word therefore. Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, brethren, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. That's the lesson for this evening. It's only to say, look at that great cloud of witnesses. Think about what Joshua did. Think about the attitude that David had. Think about the people of Nehemiah's day. Think about the great cloud of witnesses, brethren, saints departed in Eugene, Oregon. And think about the excuses we offer. The sloppy and negligent way that we so often go about stuff. Because we're the generation that has it all handed to us. Not the builders. Covered Road must come to terms with the stark realization, brethren, that we must build now or else. Because the world's not likely to just send a whole lot of freshly baked young Christians from other congregations doing the work to us in the near future. It might. We'll hope for that. In the meantime, brethren, it's time to get down in the kitchen, isn't it? Feel the heat and do some cooking. Isn't it? Now's the time. That's what I'd be feeling about it. It's not pointing fingers. It's just saying, this is the way the world works. And here we are. Harold, you did it. And we are here because of it. And we appreciate what you've been. It's tearing us apart to see you go. Okay? But it is also the living example, brethren, of what we all hope to be in our, entered into now, 94th year. Do you, brethren, have 20, 30, 40, 50 more years ahead of you before the smoke vanishes away? Let it be lived. Let it be lived like Joshua, like David, like Nehemiah, like Harold and Betty. Then things will happen. God will bless you. Please stand. As always, we offer the opportunity to respond to the gospel. If you would be baptized into Christ this evening, or seek prayer or personal Bible study, if we can help in some manner with a problem that you're wrestling with, let it be known.